That's how I got to my first AA meeting. It was October 1981, and I went to a singles bar to find this man that I was going to practice on. Nobody hit on me. They hit on my girlfriend, but not me. And I sat at the bar drinking, feeling sorry for myself. And I left to drive her home with this guy that she married. And the next thing I knew, I heard my name. And she was yelling my name out loud. And I came too. And I was heading straight for a parked truck, which I hit. And I felt so guilty, not because I hit that truck, but because she witnessed me hitting that truck. And so I called Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. And I don't remember what they said. Oh, Marvin answered the phone, and I said, I'd like to know where there's a meeting for professionals. And I don't remember what he said. But, so I figured I needed a meeting for professionals. And I was a professional drunk. I didn't want to admit I was a drunk at all. I can't remember what he said, but he wanted to say there weren't any such meetings or something like that. And I insisted. I said, I heard there's one in Center City where lawyers go to. It was Mustard Seed. So he said, oh, you mean 17th and Samson. So he told me where the meeting was, and I picked up my ex-husband, and we went to the bar to have a few drinks first. We got there late, and I sat and I looked around at you, and I said, gee whiz, boy, I had a lot of admiration for you. And I said, if I'm not careful, I'm going to end up here. And I decided that I couldn't come here till I was at least 50, because all of these things I had planned to do, I couldn't do without alcohol. I knew that. So I had to be careful. So I decided that I wasn't going to drink gin anymore, and I wasn't going to drive my car at night anymore, and I was only going to drink in front of people who I didn't have to feel guilty about how I drank. Then I wouldn't have to be humiliated anymore. I came back to AA 18 months later. And this time I sat and I went to Mustard Seed again. That's the only meeting I knew about at the time. And this time I sat in a room and I cried. And I would leave the meeting every 10 minutes or so. And I was alone. And I went into the bathroom, and I hoped that somebody was going to come in there and rescue me. I wasn't able to surrender. And after the meeting, somebody that I knew and that I had known before, I went up to him and I said, what do you do now? What do I do? I couldn't understand how you stayed sober. It didn't make any sense to me. And he said, you make a lot of meetings, especially step meetings. And I left that meeting, and I walked into a bar. I never intended to live my life without alcohol in it. I didn't think life would be worth living. And then on September the 22nd, 1983, I was with a group of women that looked up to me. None of them were alcoholic. They were in a women's therapy group. They had all been sexually abused as children, so I know that's not what made me an alcoholic. They weren't alcoholics. And they looked up to me, and I had shared at the meeting that night that I was concerned about abusing alcohol. They misunderstood me. They thought I meant that I wanted to stop drinking. I didn't. I meant that I wanted to stop having blackouts, and I wanted to stop having one-night stands. And I wanted to stop waking up in hotel rooms with strange people. And I wanted to stop making phone calls and getting my phone bill and seeing these long-distance calls and knowing I made the calls drunk and wondering what I said. And I wanted to have people stopped talking about me as they had begun to talk about me. And at this time, even my ex-husband, who never complained about my drinking, was ashamed to go out with me. And people were beginning to leave me. I wanted all of that to stop. In other words, I wanted to be able to control what happened to me when I drank, but I never, ever wanted to stop drinking. During this time, I was in such emotional pain that I lived alone, and I used to walk from my bedroom and my bathroom. You had to walk through the living room, and I would collapse on the floor and roll back and forth and say, "Dear God, please take away the pain." And I thought that that meant putting the last man back in my life that had left me. I wouldn't have prayed that prayer if I thought God was going to have some silly idea about taking booze away from me. And so that night, the women went out with me, and to support me at the restaurant, the cocktail waitress came to them, and each one of them, one by one, ordered a Coca-Cola. And as it got to me, I started to perspire because I wanted to order a Coke. It was only going to be a matter of an hour, two at the most. I could drink when I went home. The bars were still open. But when the cocktail waitress got to me, I had to order a drink. And I ordered a second drink. And before I finished that second drink, part of me left my body and I was somewhere on the ceiling. And I looked down, and I saw what I had become. And I knew that I was drinking, not because I wanted to, but because I had to. And it's the loneliest moment I have ever had in my entire life. I felt very disconnected from the entire human race. I could not touch anybody. And the worst thing was that I knew that nobody could touch me. At that moment, I lost all hope of going on, and I lost all hope of living. And a woman there said to me, "Are you okay?" And I told the lie that I had told all of my life, "I'm fine." And I left that night, and I went home, and I knew what I had to do. I had to get a prescription of sleeping pills. By this time, I knew that getting them in a drugstore wasn't going to do it. I was able to con enough people that I figured that people believed that I was together, that I could and get a doctor to give me a prescription of sleeping pills so I could do myself in before the world found out what I was. I went to work and I picked up the telephone in my office. And I don't know why, instead of calling the doctor, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to say that that had to be my higher power. Same man answered the phone. This time I asked him where there was a step meeting. I didn't know what a step meeting was, but I remembered when I went to that second meeting, somebody said you go to a lot of step meetings. And that was on a Friday that I made that call. And he told me about a meeting on a Sunday in my neighborhood. And it was the Vernon Park group. I understand that that group had just begun to have that meeting. And it was a Sunday morning, and I still remember my shoes. I remember my shoes because all I could do was look down. My head was hanging so low as I walked to that meeting. And I walked to that meeting like a leper going to a leper colony. And I came to turn myself into you. And I didn't even know why or what was pushing me to stay alive instead of killing myself as I intended. And I went to that meeting so full of shame. And they were on the 12th step. And there was some reading that was going on. They were reading the step. And all I remember is they got to this part and they were reading that part in the 12th step that talks about us and relationships with other people. And it's that part that says we either end up being dependent on people and having them take care of us, or we dominate them and run the show And they end up leaving us alone anyway. And we end up alone. And it, in that part of the 12th step, it talks about AA having a very special meaning. And that we never have to be alone again. And there was a woman who was sharing. I don't remember her whole story. I don't remember the woman's name. But I know she was telling a story. And God, I thought I was bad. She was talking about these things that she had done and where alcohol had taken her, what alcohol had cost her. And there were things that I could identify with. But really got me, she was smiling through the whole thing. And then she was talking about what she had gotten. And what I got from that, and I didn't know it, was hope. And a woman came up to me after that meeting and she handed me a directory and she said, Dorothea suggested that you go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I said, okay. I didn't know that you could say no. So I started my 90 meetings in 90 days. And it would have been that Monday that I would have gone to the One Parkway group the first time. And by that Tuesday, I went to a meeting and I had already heard somebody mentioned sponsorship between my first meeting and my third meeting. I was so scared to death that this program was not going to work for me. When I came to this program, I believed that I was damaged goods. I believed I was damaged beyond repair. I thought that my life was supposed to have a tragic ending and that I couldn't hope for anything more. I was so scared. I went to that third meeting and more than I was scared of my own judgment. I no longer trusted me. I put my hand up and I said, I heard you're supposed to have a sponsor. I didn't know what a sponsor was. But I have trouble asking for help. That was one of the lies I told. The truth was I didn't trust myself to pick anybody at that point. And after the meeting, a woman come up to me and she said, Dorothy, I'm 3 years sober and I haven't sponsored anybody yet. And she was still shaking. And she said, but I'm willing to try if you want to take a chance. And I said, okay. And she said, I said, what do I do? She gave me her name and her number and she put it on a piece of paper and she said, you call me at 10 o'clock tonight. And again, I didn't know you could say no. I said, okay. And I called her at 10 o'clock tonight. And I called her every day. And then I continued to go to meetings that you should get a home group. And this sponsor told me that at the end of your 90 days, that's enough time, pick out a group that you're going to make your home group. And a home group is a place where you make a commitment and you go to that group. You go to any other meetings you want, but the home group is where you make a commitment. And that's how the One Parkway became my home group. Then when I was 4 months sober, a little less than that, there was this woman that came into my home group. And she looked wonderful. And you talk about somebody having something that you want. And she was smiling and people knew her. And I think I was chairing. By this time I had my 90 days and I was chairing my home group for the very first time and I was scared to death. I was afraid that if you made a mistake that people were going to yell at you and stuff like that and humiliate you. And I sat and I was so terrified I could barely follow the format. And this woman came up to me after the meeting and she was kind. And she told me that I was needed in Alcoholics Anonymous and she told me to keep coming back. And she said some other things to me and she gave me her number. And I called her up, and I remember the other thing. She was talking about spirituality. That's what it was. And I called her up, and I said I wanted her to be my spiritual sponsor because I had read in the steps that you should have a spiritual advisor. And she asked me if I had read the pamphlet, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship. And I hadn't. And then she asked me why I wanted her to be my sponsor, and I also told her that she knew I had another sponsor, and I don't think she really approved of having two sponsors. But after I gave her some information, She agreed. And I'm so glad that she did. And during that first year in sobriety, I called two sponsors every night. I wore myself out. I was so afraid that the program wasn't going to work for me, that the fear was a gift. I went to two meetings every day, sometimes three. I went to work. I called people in the program from work. After work, I went to my home group. I got into service because I was afraid to talk to people, and nobody called it service. If they had called it service, it would have scared me to death. But I went to the meeting early because I didn't trust myself to go home. The meeting was at 6:30. I got off at work at 5. I was at the group at 5:15. So I started to set up the meeting. Wallace used to be there. He'd be there with his newspaper. We'd set up the meeting. He'd read his newspaper. I didn't have to talk to him. We set up the meeting and clean up afterwards. And I didn't know that that was service. And that's how I got that home group. And then I would go home at night and I would talk to both sponsors. The second one, she's good for 2 hours today. You know, she's my sponsor today. And if I'm going to call her, I got her on a once a week schedule because it's long distance now. And I know I got to block out 2 hours at least to talk to the sponsor. But it was scary. And I didn't think that I was ever going to get a year of sobriety. I was so afraid that the night before my first anniversary, I stayed up the entire night. I thought somebody was going to kidnap me and pour booze down my throat. At 3:00 in the morning, I was awake and I realized it was the first time that I began to believe that the program truly was going to work for me after all. And I got down on my knees and I said, God, thanks for saving my life, for giving me another chance at life, for giving me the precious gift of sobriety and leading me to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you told me when I came here not to quit before my miracles, and I didn't think there were ever going to be any miracles for me. I thought there were miracles for you. You know, when I was talking about I used to go out with my therapist and be this little patient, I remember going to this, and what it was, my therapist used to read little excerpts from our life stories, and then professionals would make predictions as to what our problems were going to be in life. And I remember, and then we would come up on stage afterwards, you know, so they'd like little specimens or something. And I remember being at this meeting one time, and she had read parts of my story. And they discussed it, what was going to happen to this woman with this story. And the things that these professionals were saying was that she'll never be capable of having a sustained relationship. And there were some other nevers that they said about me. When I was 13 months sober, I was so lonely. I was so very lonely, and I felt so guilty about being lonely. And I was talking to my sponsor, and I was telling her about how guilty I felt. And she said, Dorothy, it's normal for you to want to have a mate, and that you don't have to feel guilty about it, but you don't have to act on it the way you used to act on it when you were drinking. Instead of having one-night stands to get hugs, I went to AA meetings and talked about how tough it was staying sober, and I got hugs. And so she said that it was normal and that I could talk to my higher power. And I got on my knees one day in my bedroom and I said, God, if you want me to be alone for the rest of my life, then please give me what I need to accept that. But if you don't, you got to pick them, because I don't have a good track record in that area. And I heard it all this weekend. I said, I don't want anybody in my life that's going to interfere with my sobriety and my spiritual growth. And there were many circumstances that led up to the miracle happening that I had nothing to do with it. Some of it had to do with rejection. I had to give up things in sobriety. I had to give up old friends. I had to give up old images. I had to give up people whose acceptance of me and approval of me I wanted. And there was a woman that I was friends with that I wanted her approval, and I had to quit something that I couldn't handle because I heard I needed to put my energy onto getting sober, and I couldn't handle being Superwoman anymore. So I had to quit this professional association I was in, and this woman said to me, Dorothy, if everybody who had a handicap laid down and died, there would be no Helen Kellers. And I wanted to drink for 2 weeks. After that, I was so depressed. But I didn't, and I went to meetings and I talked about it. And as a result of that woman rejecting me, when another woman said, I'm going to Barbados for a vacation, I said, can I come? And I went there, and I went to an AA meeting there, and I didn't go right away. I made a mistake. I went on my fifth day, and I went to this meeting because I picked up a drink the night before. I didn't drink it accidentally because I wasn't following suggestions that I learned in a beginner's meeting, which was never go back to a drink that you've put down. And I didn't follow it because I smelt the drink, and I picked it up, and it was vodka. And I spit it out, and I was horrified, and I made a deal with God. I said, God, if you get me through the night, I promise I'll be at that meeting tomorrow morning. And I was the first one there, and this second car pulled up at this meeting, and there was this man there, and I asked him the way to an AA meeting. He said, just follow me. He claims he's been following me ever since, but that's not so. We had a very long courtship, 18 months. I sent him my written 10th step every single day. And I kept telling him, you don't know how sick I am. I'm not ready for a relationship. I went to, the hardest thing I ever had to do was go to my home group and confess. Even though I was over a year sober, I was afraid that my home group members were going to think that I didn't take my sobriety seriously anymore. And the worst thing was that he was an AA fanatic, and I didn't like those. I hadn't talked about being in service up to this point, you know. I was involved in my home group, but I had an office in my group. There were people who would come around and talk service this and service that and service this and gratitude that. And I would think to myself, well, right already, you know, get a life. Not me. And so this man was an AA fanatic. On our first date, he asked me if I wanted to hear an AA tape. I said, God, this can't be it. But I knew about the third legacy procedure, and he didn't. So I said, if God's will is for us to be together, how will we ever decide where to live? Because he lived in Barbados and I lived in Philadelphia, 4,000 miles apart. So I said, maybe we ought to use the third legacy procedure. And so we talked about that, so it sounded like he thought it was a good idea. We thought it was a wonderful idea, plus we already knew what God's will was for us. We had decided it was to live in Barbados. I had my job interview. He had his apartment that we were going to live in. We put Philadelphia on a piece of paper in Barbados, and we got on our knees, and we shook it up, and we said a prayer. Pulled it out, said Philadelphia. Immediately went into a depression. He checked with his sponsor and said, and he said to his sponsor, do you think, you know, this is God's will? And the sponsor said, I never would have done it that way, but I mean, could be. Could be. Then I told him, I said, well, we have to have separate home groups. And my AA brother, our anniversaries are 3 days apart, Hugo, invited this man to make One Parkway his home group. And I said, but we can't have the same home group. And he said, you don't tell me how to work my program? And I thought it couldn't be done. And I'll tell you, I then began to learn the keys to a happy marriage in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's called the 12 Traditions. And the first one that I learned, I thought that in that, I used to think that in a marriage it was about maintaining your individuality. And I was so scared of losing that. It's AA in my home group and being in service that I learned about our common welfare coming first. And that in order for us to thrive, we do that together. And it's been taking the traditions and applying them to my marriage and learning what I learned in service to do that, that I have a happy marriage today. Today I've learned about what our three legacies really mean. You know, I've learned through teaching, through having a wonderful sponsor, about the 12 steps, and she always said that the healing are in the steps. And whenever I call her up and I complain about how rough it was going, and she said, pep up your step meetings. I learned about unity, and I don't believe that you can learn the traditions without having a home group. And a home group is not where everybody likes you all the time and where you like everybody. And I learned about having a commitment and what a commitment means, and I learned about growing. Because that same sponsor taught me that you don't run when the going gets rough, and that having a home group does not mean that you have a home group till you get a resentment. And I had to chair the meeting when I had resentments. I had to share my book with people I was mad at when we were reading the steps. I had to hold my hand. I had to make amends sometimes on the group level for times when I had showed out and didn't practice restraint of tongue. I learned in that home group what real love was, and I couldn't have learned the traditions if I hadn't been able to experience them. It was also in that group that I learned about service, and it was through being married to that AA fanatic that I really got indoctrinated to service. Because he picked One Parkway as his home group, and they elected him first as alternate GSR. And I had a car, and he didn't. And he made me go to many assemblies. And I said, I'm bored, I'm bored, I'm bored, I'm bored. And it was really because I didn't know what was going on, and I was mad. And I don't know when the click started, but somewhere along the line, I got interested. He became GSR, and then my home group elected me alternate GSR. There's nothing like having, first of all, a GSR can boss you around if you're an alternate, but when it's your husband, it's even worse. At the monthly district meeting, he made me do the report. And I had a job in service. And somewhere again, somewhere along the line, I began to fall in love. And I think the proudest day, one of my proudest days in sobriety, was when my home group elected me to be GSR. One of the most painful days was when I had to give up that office because the higher power had other plans for us, and we moved to New Jersey. And, you know, we just keep going on growing and passing it on. And I remember back in those days when I used to call Charlotte and she would talk to me till 3 o'clock in the morning. And 3 o'clock in the morning, I mean, and we'd start talking at 8 at night. And I'd feel so bad that somebody was giving up all of this time to me. And I kept saying, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. I just didn't think that I deserved this much attention, and it would make me uncomfortable. And it wasn't just her. It was so many people. I was spoiled rotten in Alcoholics Anonymous, just loved to death. And I definitely couldn't understand it because I couldn't love myself. And I kept wanting to say, thank you, thank you, thank you. And Charlotte said to me, Dorothy, you don't have to be grateful. Because I'm only passing on to you what was freely given to me. Freely ye have been given. You know? Freely give, you know, what you have been given. And she taught me something, that the way that I show my gratitude, and it's the theme of this conference, is to pass it on. I pray that the day never comes when I think that I'm too busy, or that I'm too sober, or I've grown too much, or that there's so many people that I don't have to do my part, that I don't have to forget to pass it on. I look out and I see my sponsor that I love very much, who passed on, not in passing it on, not just to me. And then I see one of the young women that I have the privilege to sponsor today, Lisa. And she's, I'm not going to say her sobriety months, because I'll get them wrong and she'll be mad at me, but she's over a year sober. And she has a sponsee that's 30 days sober. And she was talking to me about how excited she is to have the opportunity to pass it on. I'm so grateful that all that has been given to me, you know, and I know that I didn't do anything to deserve any of this. When I say that I love you today, I know that it's because you taught me how to love. And Tony, I love you very much. And I want to say thank you all, and thank the committee for having me. Thank you.